Break out!
Stay tuned, folks. Coming at you, Civil Rights in Santa Cruz. Yet another show, November 29th, 2001. Bathrobes, Beers, Broadsides. Disc has seen better days. Could this be the end of We Didn't Start the Fire? Well, let's start the show instead. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And this is, of course, Bathrobes, Beers, Broadsides. Your very own open line to Robert Norris, that's me, and, of course, the Free Radio community. And issues we discuss usually on this show are those that affect poor people outside, inside, and inside and outside. And you're invited to join us. We have a number of things that have happened in the last week, ranging from the infamous Irwin Joseph Camp Paradise decision on Monday, which I will be reading in its entirety and then commenting on at great length and giving you an opportunity to talk about. That's the trial for criminal camping of four members of Camp Paradise, the clean and sober homeless encampment on the San Lorenzo River, which has been there, well, publicly since about May, and probably for some months before that, which it was created by homeless people themselves under the sometimes little authoritarian leadership of Larry Templeton. But it's been surviving. People have been holding together better than I think they do in separate circumstances, and they are, of course, being persecuted by the city, harassed by the police department, and have received various warnings now that next week will be the end of Camp Paradise. Of course, this is a warning that has been heard before and given before. However, we've got to judge it for what it's worth, and we're going to talk about that as we get into the show. Perhaps someone from Camp Paradise will call in. We haven't had a lot of success in reaching Camp Paradise lately, I'm told, because camp co-founder Larry Templeton's cellular phone is off most of the time because he ain't got the bucks. He ain't got the do-re-mi to keep it on. And that could be rather important if there is, in fact, a crackdown, as many of us fear will happen in the next week. Rumors are rife, and I'll be going into that, as I said, in the next 2 hours. Next 2 hours you are going to be tuned, I hope, to Bathroom Spears Broadsides, and should you choose to call in here at 96.3 FM, the phone number is 427-3772. 427-FRSC. That's for Free Radio Santa Cruz. Easy to remember, and the line is working, so it's up to you if you want to be a part of the show. and join in the general merriment. To begin with, just to keep a little warmth in the hearth after that stickety-doo-dah Billy Joel number, that we may actually have to, dare I say it, retire Billy Joel. That would be quite something to do here. I'm going to instead turn now to give us a kind of a shift in tune. We're going to play a little bit of a CD that's a little old, but it's got some satire that some folks may still find pertinent. It's called It's Not Over Till the First Lady Sings. It's by the Capitol Steps. We're going to begin with Blame It on the Boss at NASA, or actually NASA.
Space is the final frontier. And so, in a galaxy close to Earth, a NASA explorer went forth to charter unknown territories. And when it veered off course, the men at NASA, being manly men, rugged men with testosterone who chewed up roast beef sandwiches for lunch, real men, attempted to do what no real man has ever done before. Ask for directions. But the explorer lost all contact with Earth, and unknown to anyone, landed here.
Ow. Anybody know how to get to Mars? NASA thinks their probe could be really lost. Far from the globe, at enormous cost. Since I did not hit my Martian goal, now NASA thinks I'm in a big black hole. Blame it on the boss at NASA, 'cause I'm not on Mars. Someone tell the boss at NASA, hey, send a car. Everybody knows that space is not a void. Out here you meet the biggest asteroids. Blame it on the boss at NASA, 'cause I'm way off base. Whoa, here comes a cute little number from Venus.
Watch out, honey, you'll burn up in my atmosphere.
All right.
Let the engine start.
We'll go round the globe.
You don't seem so smart.
Hey, I'm one big pro.
Began to veer.
She was so divine.
Hey, Martian probe, your planet or mine?
Oh, blame a big colossal nova.
We ran out of luck.
We turned left around the nova,
and we soon broke up.
Everybody knows that men are all from Mars, and women are from Venus.
So we are
gonna tell the boss at NASA about this recent Mars disaster.
When our relationship went faster, he said,
I need more space.
Now, here's the deal. It's me, Ross Perot. And it's nice to see so many members of the Reform Party here tonight. Now, we got a lot to handle, so let's go ahead and let's get right to it, okay? Now, we've got the election coming up. And you got the other two parties. You know, you got the Democrats and Republicans. And to be honest, there's not a dime's worth of difference between them. But with the Reform Party, you've got variety. All right? First of all, you got me, Ross the Boss. Then you got that, the fly in the ointment, the governor of Minnesota, Jesse the Body Ventura.
I prefer being called Jesse the Mind.
Well, I prefer to do the hoochie coo with Joey Heatherton, but you can't have everything. Now, listen here. Listen, I got some advice for you, son. Now, if you ever want to get into any higher office than governor, you got to heed my advice. First of all, have you ever heard yourself talk? Oh, my goodness. You have got the funniest accent I ever heard. Honestly, you go like this. You go, I'm from Minnesota, Minnesota. Now, son, how do you expect American voters to take you seriously when you talk so funny? Another thing, you got to watch what you say. You can't just spout off the mouth like that. No, you got to be more like me. You got to know when to be quiet. Jesse Ventura, you're a flake. Go jump into 10,000 lakes. You spoke in Playboy magazine. Now Minnesota popped the spleen.
Yeah.
Shut your trap.
Jesse Ventura is the mind.
Your mind is stuck in your behind.
Church-going people, they're all weak.
Well, at least they think before they speak.
Yeah.
Shut your trap.
In my next life, I'll be a bra.
Huh?
That's right, the biggest bra you ever saw.
Then you'll convince us on the tube.
That's right.
That in this life, you are a boob.
Yeah.
Don't come back.
No.
Go on, get out of here. Go, give me a record.
And we may do the same with that disc. Looks like it's going to be just you, me, the phones, and the tapes. I've got some interesting reading material here, too. This is a two-hour show we traditionally devote to local politics. I'm actually going to try to kind of involve a few local folks. We also have some interviews, which we've been following. Here's a brief one.
November 15th, we're in front of the public library, main branch downtown, talking to
Diane Ramsey.
And Diane, you have been around town for how long?
About 30 years.
And you've been keeping your eye on the civil rights for homeless people issue for how long?
About 15 years. I remember they first started passing laws against poor people, making it difficult for people. First, they started picking on people, calling them loitering, if they would be hanging around town. And it was to keep moving. For a while, they had made it illegal to be a street musician in this town, which is one of the ways some people can get funds and do work for it. And then they made it difficult for people to sleep here. They made it illegal to sleep, which is a ludicrous thing since it's biologically impossible to live without sleeping.
Now, you yourself have lived in a vehicle and subject to that criminal sleeping ban.
Yes, twice I was in my vehicle. Fortunately, I have family in this town, so I had a place to shower and cook, and a safe place even to park my vehicle. And I'm a recipient of disability checks, so I can, by living in my vehicle for a month, I could get the 2 months needed when you have rent and they want first and last. So for being homeless, I was one of the more fortunate in that respect. I had an income. I have an income.
You yourself are currently living in housing?
Yes, I have a place now. I'm very fortunately.
But you have not the kindest things to say about the fine city council, right?
You know, I've seen the city council, even people I myself have voted for and considered compassionate liberal people wanting to help, sidestep issues, put them off, make them the last thing to come up in the agenda so there's not time to finish the discussion. How much talk do we have to have about opening some spaces that we have locked that are publicly owned in order to house people, even if it's just overnight? Open the doors from 9 p.m. to 7 a.m., something like that. Even something like the Civic Auditorium that sits empty while there's people outside in the rain, homeless. I mean, to me, it seems no one really is making an effort to help people, but finding the most polite way to sweep it under the carpet.
I spoke to incoming Mayor Christopher Crone, assuming he's elected this morning, and I asked him first, would he host a rent control forum, and his answer was no. And then I asked him, you know, what are you doing about suspending the sleeping and camping bans, which you voted for 3 years ago when you didn't have the votes. Now you do have the votes if you actually did this. And he said, first he said, if anyone but you were addressing me on this, I might deal with it. And I said, well, it's the issue, it's not me. And he said, it depends on who talks to me about it. And I said, What about the issue? So at the current time, you have no plans to put this on the agenda, and in essence, that's what he confirmed. So at the moment, nothing is being done except, of course, plans to remove and destroy Camp Paradise, the only homeless-run campground in Santa Cruz and anyway in California that I know of.
And Camp Paradise has actually made some significant news lately. You may have been reading the Metro yesterday or the Good Times today, both of which have stories and fairly good ones, particularly the Metro, on the Camp Paradise trial, the trial of four Camp Paradise folks for August 3rd camping tickets. And they were found guilty, preposterously, I might add. Not even if you believe the law is constitutional, there has to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt. And there was by no means, at least for three of the four, proof beyond a reasonable doubt. No proof at all, actually, was presented, or very little, certainly not beyond a reasonable doubt, not even a preponderance of the evidence. I sat through the entire trial. It was a two-day trial, Tuesday and Wednesday of, or Monday and Tuesday of last week, one of those days. And it was interesting to watch. The defense lawyers, for my money, were pretty good, Matthew Williamson and Paul Sanford. I've criticized Sanford at different times on this show and no doubt will again, but he raised a lot of issues at trial eloquently, sometimes actually repetitively, but I think he got the point home to the audience and perhaps to some of the media, though I think a number of key points were missed by the media when they looked over the trial. The Mercury News did a story the next day, as did the Santa Cruz Urinal, or Sentinel, as they sometimes call themselves. And I actually did have some correspondence with the writer of the Sentinel story, who claimed that her story was cut, and indeed it was somewhat cut. I saw the full story, but it wasn't very much cut. There just wasn't much there to begin with, but there was something. And we're going to be talking, again, a lot about that trial. And why is that trial important? After all, the defendants were found guilty. As I said, first they were found guilty on no evidence or very little evidence, and then they were denied the necessity of defense. That is to say, they were allowed to put on the necessity defense, but it was held not to have been proved, which it's always possible because the defense does have, unlike in any other trial where the prosecution has to prove not just by a preponderance of the evidence, but by proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a very high standard, that the defendant is guilty, although in fact in most trials in Santa Cruz the cards are stacked in favor of the prosecution. It's hard for the defense to go up against the well-oiled machine of the DA, even in cases where they have a jury, and you can appeal to the hopefully the justice sentiments of the jury. But in any case, it usually requires proof beyond a reasonable doubt. But for necessity defense, the defense has to prove by a preponderance of the evidence, 51% of the evidence, that 6 points adhere. And what I'm going to do, I guess, we'll start out with is we're going to begin by talking about, well, hearing a bit of the dialogue around the trial the day that the trial began in the courtroom down there at 701 Ocean Street in Department 1. Irwin Joseph was the commissioner who heard the case. The prosecuting attorney was a city attorney or a deputy city attorney or an assistant deputy or an apprentice assistant deputy city attorney. She was a pretty much the low woman on the totem pole. I think they dumped this case on her. Her name was Jennifer Pouchot. And as I said, the two defense lawyers were volunteers, both of them. Paul Sanford from Santa Cruz, and then a Monterey County fellow that had just volunteered at the very last minute because Sanford was concerned that he had a conflict of interest. That is to say, he was originally a defense for everybody, but then he realized he'd been offered a deal for Larry Templeton, and for him to honestly represent Templeton might require him to misrepresent or not fully represent the other defendants in his vigorous or appropriate a fashion. So he got a second attorney in there to help out. Plus, it always helps to have two attorneys when you're dealing with a large case like this. And he and Williamson put in dozens of hours of work, probably scores of hours on this case, particularly he did, and they're to be commended for it. And I tip my hat to Sanford for taking this trial. And actually, as I said, he got a significant amount of media out on this issue, even though the Sentinel did a very small story, as I said. And I don't know how the television did it. And the ultimate outcome we're going to be hearing about, and of course most of you out there have already heard about it, the defendants were found guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and not the necessity defense was not proved, but all the sentences were pretty much suspended, two because of physical disability or medical need, and two because they had performed community service at the campground itself. And for some folks, this was considered quite a victory. Unfortunately, for the police, it may be the green light to go ahead and attack Camp Paradise, or at least that seems to be the rumor that I heard at a Huff meeting from a highly placed source who had been talking to some police officials on the issue. It's hard to tell. There's all kinds of uncertainty around the issue. But let's go back to the corridors of the courtroom on the day of the trial and hear a little bit of conversation there. I didn't make a motion to record this trial. Anyone can, by the way, you can, just to file a court paper, say you want to record it. You can either record it for personal use, which is a 980D motion, as we call it, or you can record it for broadcast, which is another motion which usually is scrutinized more carefully by our secrecy preferring courts. They like to keep their own stuff pretty close to the chest. You don't want to get too embarrassed about what goes on in there after all. Irwin Joseph said he would let me know if the tapes, which the court themselves, as I mentioned, I guess, in a previous show, the court itself actually had this whole proceeding recorded, which is quite astonishing, actually, in an infraction case, the infraction being the lowest level of crime. You have misdemeanors, infractions, and at the highest level, actually, you have infractions at the bottom, misdemeanors in the middle, and felonies at the top. And felonies, of course, are the worst. Infraction trials usually don't even get a court reporter, much less a recording, but this motion was made, and there's a lot of publicity, so Irwin Joseph, who has never done it before, and I've never heard of an infraction trial getting a tape recording by the court, now it could become a regular thing, because thanks to researcher and civil rights activist, he calls himself, I guess, a citizen advocate, Richard Quigley, we now have the legal forms to require courts in infraction cases not only to record them for us with their own equipment, because one's own equipment may not be sufficient. I have a little tape recorder, but it doesn't always get the prosecution and the judge and the witnesses. But if there are microphones distributed throughout the courtroom, as there have to be for there to be a good recording, then you get a good recording. And now we have that option open to us. And that happened during the Camp Paradise trial, which was really quite something. And hopefully, if you have a camping trial, you'll make a motion that the whole thing be recorded by the court, and if you're indigent, that a tape be provided for you on that issue. And that is within your rights to get, and we're going to make sure that we get those tapes for Camp Paradise. I'll be talking to Commissioner Joseph tomorrow to see that if those tapes are available, and also to see if they can be broadcast. He initially didn't want them broadcast because he thought that they were not an official transcript of the court, and I said, well, I'd be happy to stipulate and qualify in any playing of those tapes that they're not in any way an official transcript. So we'll see what happens tomorrow when I approach the bench, as they say. But let's approach the courtroom now and hear a little bit of chit-chat about what was going on with the trial when it was about to begin.
Also waiting here is, what's your name? You to this neck of the courthouse?
Curiosity.
About?
Homeless.
Aha. Uh-huh. So you're here for the Camp Paradise trial. You know, the go to sleep, go to jail trial?
Yes.
Or at least get a ticket trial.
Yeah.
Have you been homeless yourself, Bill?
Oh, about 14, 15 years ago.
And you have friends who are homeless now?
Yes.
Anything you want to say to the folks out there?
They ought to leave them alone.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Hey.
Howdy.
You're dressed up and ready to go. I like your tie, Squirrel.
Thank you.
Any comments, any predictions about today's trial?
Not really.
Boy.
Just hoping we win.
All right. That's a hope I think shared by a lot of us.
Thanks.
Thank you. And, Madam, you're in a wheelchair. What brings you to this neck of the woods?
Somebody told me there was a party down here.
Somebody told you wrong. This is a lynching party.
Oh. Is it refreshments?
It's not very refreshing, I gotta tell you.
Hmm.
So you're a resident of Camp Paradise.
Yeah.
How old are you?
Ah!
48.
And how long have you been in the wheelchair?
About a year.
How difficult is it being in a wheelchair outdoors in a on a river encampment?
It's pretty rough, but people at Camp Paradise help.
And how long have you been with Camp Paradise?
Since March.
And has it gotten better? Has it gotten worse? How's it going?
Since when?
Since March.
Well, everybody knows that it got better. Yep.
Anything you want to add?
Nope.
Thanks.
This is a homeless file.
Uh-huh. We're looking at a homeless file, and we're talking to Chris.
We're trying to figure out the... What were we trying to figure out?
Some
deal.
Notes on that homeless file, special musical notes. So, Chris, are you... Any predictions about the trial today? You are given some legal assistance to this trial, right?
No.
No legal assistance?
No.
Any illegal assistance?
Yes.
All right. So I guess this could be you being tried today if they had chosen to ticket you, right?
No, it would be, well, yes.
Because you yourself live in Camp Paradise.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you.
Going through your facility, the operators tend to be very...
And that was the beginning of Camp Paradise. What actually happened at the trial, and actually that's there's going to be a lot of writing about that. In fact, there already has been a lot of writing, and it'll be some of this stuff is going to be out in the next Street Spirit, the weekly homeless newspaper you can pick up on the streets from homeless people for a dollar, or you can pick it up from the home of Friends of Camp Paradise advocate Carl Wilson at 137 Felker Street, or Becky Johnson's place at Plymouth. I think it's 218A, if I remember correctly. That's where she lives. You can give a call to either Becky or Carl if you want to get the latest Street Spirit. Should be out next week, early next week. Long article on the trial of Camp Paradise. And also you can get it on the internet. If you give a call to Huff, 423-HUFF, you want to be signed up for kind of Huff Internet publications, be happy to put you on the Huff Internet list, and we'll send you out our propaganda as we send it out. And indeed, we may soon be making a usable website. Some folks are working on that already, so you can actually tune into the voluminous archives of Huff, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, a group I've been working with for about a decade or more. Talking about the Camp Paradise trial here on Free Radio Santa Cruz at 96.3, and if you want to call in and give your thoughts on anything that you're hearing or think you'd like to say, maybe change the direction of things, 427-3772. But the Camp Paradise trial, as I said, went on for 2 days, and it's, wow, it's a kind of it's a large subject to cover. I guess perhaps maybe the best place to start is at the end rather than at the beginning with the court decision. I'm going to read the court decision. Court decision was issued on Monday, the Monday after the trial. That was this last Monday, 3 days ago. And it was issued by Commissioner Irwin Joseph, that kind of a friendly fellow who initially seemed to be making a lot of rulings that favored the prosecution, and then issued a decision that really didn't make a lot of sense. Though some of the things he says it's hard to disagree with, some of the key points are, in my mind, the most... Well, maybe they're unconscious on his part, but they seem to be political cover for the city council, political cover for the legislative branch, which has failed, as Irwin Joseph recognizes. Anyway, let me read you the decision of Irwin Joseph of the Superior Court Commissioner, November 26, Department 1, 10:30 a.m., in the cases of Larry Templeton, Catherine Phillips, that's the woman in the wheelchair, K, Jeffrey Jepson, also known as Squirrel, and Randy Sue Winchell, another woman involved. These cases were tried before the court on November 19th and 20th, 2001. Jennifer Pouchot appeared for the city attorney, Matthew Williamson for Mr. Templeton, Paul Sanford for Mr. Jepson, Ms. Winchell, Mr. Paff, Mr. Painter, Mr. Keyes, and Ms. Phillips. By motion by the defense, David Paff, Eugene Painter, and Sean Keyes were dismissed for insufficient evidence at the close of the city's case. Now, what does this mean, by the way? Just let's interrupt this for a moment. There actually were 10 people that initially went into court, 8 made it, I guess, as far as this. Several of them left along the way, and several charges were dropped. Seven people showed up that day in court. And what happened was that Officer Seeley, who was sitting in the courtroom throughout the entire proceeding right next to the city attorney, not excluded as a witness, as most people who are witnesses are. They usually, the judge, if on a motion from either the defense or the prosecution, says, "Will all people who are witnesses please leave the courtroom until such time as you're called?" And they do. They leave. Well, Officer Seeley was one of the two key witnesses, but he was also the assisting person to the city attorney, so he didn't have to leave. He got to stay. The prosecution got that advantage. Well, Officer Seeley was asked to identify the defendants. There were initially, as I said, seven of them. He couldn't identify... Well, actually, he couldn't identify four of them. But the fourth one he called by the wrong name. He called her Brenda. And that should have been enough to indicate a false identification. But again, the commissioner was leaning over backward to help the prosecution, it seemed to me, in some respects. And so that person stayed in. But three other people, just there was no identification, so they were simply discharged. Seeley didn't remember their faces, didn't remember who they were. And you have to be able to identify the defendant in a crime. Of course, it happened on August 3rd, some months ago. But it tends to go to what the police actually think are going to happen in these cases. If they seriously thought there was going to be a contested trial, they would prepare more carefully. But I think what they really intend to do is scare homeless people with these camping tickets away. They don't expect people to go to trial. They expect them to disappear into the bushes. So this is, of course, a rather cynical point of view. And, you know, it should be in this country that you are only put a charge against someone unless you're very serious, unless there is a real crime taking place, unless you intend to pursue it. And, of course, this isn't being done generally, I don't think, necessarily with the prosecution in these cases with the police. And it certainly wasn't being done here. So the trial began, and there were only four defendants left: Kay, Larry Templeton, Squirrel, and Randy. There were two women and two men. Initially in such a trial, the prosecution is supposed to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that each of the defendants is guilty of the crime. And of course, the crime here has to do with establishing and maintaining a campsite with the intent to stay overnight. And this is a much more difficult thing to prove in a fair court, in an impartial court, than the sleeping ban, which is the paragraph, two paragraphs before. There are actually three bans that are part of the camping ordinance: the sleeping ban, the blanket ban, and the camping ban. The camping ban, it was the issue here for all the defendants. The camping ban says you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant established and maintained a campsite with the intention of remaining overnight. Now, that doesn't mean you found them lying in a tent and that proves anything. It doesn't mean even if you saw them camping the day before that means anything. You have to prove they have the specific intent to remain overnight at that point when you came upon them. And it's actually a very hard standard, and perhaps why so few cases are charged under Municipal Code 6.36.010C. Instead, they charge under A, which is the sleeping ban. And the sleeping ban just requires you prove that someone was asleep. And the officer can say, "Oh, well, he was breathing rhythmically and snoring," and the defense can say, no, "I was standing around jumping up and down," and of course the judge will look at the police officer and say, guilty. At least I've seen that happen frequently, unless you have a number of witnesses and all kinds of other evidence. So it's a much easier deal for the police to use the sleeping ban. Well, why then didn't they use the sleeping ban in the Camp Paradise case? Well, Attorney Sanford speculated a couple of things, which may be true. One of them was that the sleeping ban in the last few years in Santa Cruz has gotten a lot of notoriety. It is regarded as a law which is really a frontal human rights violation. I mean, if a person cannot sleep outside after 11 o'clock at night, and that's what the sleeping ban says, there shall be no sleeping on public property between 11 and 8:30 in the morning, or in your own vehicle, or on much private property too, actually, or in any structure that is not a house or hotel. That's the sleeping ban. And it's really quite outrageous. Even conservative folks who hear about it just can't quite understand what a modern, enlightened society would do having such a law. And the answer is it was proposed by the police chief Peeney, was his name, back in 1978, after the Scotts Creek Bluff folks won their long trial. They were actually tried under county statutes or state trespass statutes, as well as a county camping law. And the jury nullified. The jury said, we don't care if they violated the law. You can't grab a community, seize their vehicles, and do what you did to them. We find them all not guilty. And so the city, several months later, responded to this by putting together the sleeping ban, which is a combination of a variety of laws. And the sleeping ban has been notorious ever since. It is a law which really doesn't have much justification. And indeed, in his decision, Irwin Joseph actually suggested that the necessity defense, the defense that you had to do something because you needed to avert a greater evil, even if what you did was technically illegal, the necessity defense could be more effectively used in the case of the sleeping ban, but he said not in case of the camping ban. That was his ultimate decision. But why did the sleeping ban not get charged? Well, there's been a lot of controversy around the sleeping ban, and putting sleeping ban tickets forward would, it was speculated, put the city council on the hot seat, because the city council, a majority of the city council, has promised to decriminalize sleeping, including our own former mayor and still sitting council member Fitzmaurice, who is a Green Party member, who for a year, as I pointed out, has been violating the Green Party platform on the sleeping ban. Every one of them has said, we want to end the sleeping ban. And indeed, last summer, they tried to establish summer of 2000, safe sleeping zones, or they made some perfunctory motions some faltering steps were taken in that direction. And then when the police chief objected and Catherine Byers ran the other way, and things of that sort began to happen, they collapsed. And even though they have the votes now, they won't even allow it to be discussed on the agenda, the sleeping ban. So the sleeping ban, Attorney Sanford speculated at the Camp Paradise trial, was not being used because it was something that was a hot-button issue in the community, and to have a bunch of people tried for just sleeping would be politically difficult for the city council and the city, because they're using the city attorney to try the case. It would also make the necessity defense easier. And why would that be? Well, the necessity defense requires you show that what you're doing, even though it's illegal, needs to be done to prevent a greater evil. And there's a decision which was a key part of our trial called the Eichhorn decision, concerning a man in Santa Ana who slept outside because the shelters were generally full, although he didn't check that particular night. And he tried to he felt that to try to go somewhere else other than where he was at the time was equally illegal everywhere, would have been to he didn't really have any other options but illegal options, so he chose one which was to sleep downtown. I think it was in a fairly well-lighted area. And that the judge refused to let him use the necessity defense. It went up to the California Supreme Court, and they said, no, you have to let him use the defense of necessity, which means you have to let him argue. You have to let him argue that indeed he had to sleep there because sleep is a biological necessity, because he was averting other dangers that were more important. And I'm still actually trying to track down what happened to that guy's case. But one of the key things about the decision was that every camping case and every sleeping case is now allowed to use the necessity defense. And so the sleeping ban, had it been brought to court and charged against the defendants, the first thing that the defense would have said was, well, you have to sleep at night, and there's no legal place for these people to go because all the shelters are full. Necessity proved. Next case. And that's something that the city attorney didn't want to stand for, because they can't deal with the idea of having homeless people non-criminals. Homeless people actually have some basic human rights in this town. So they said, okay, we're going to charge them with camping, setting up a tent, and so forth. And that's not a necessity. You don't have to set up a tent. You can go to, maybe sleep may be a necessity. They didn't say this, but I think that was one of their fears. But certainly putting up a tent is not. And eventually they got Commissioner Joseph to buy that argument, and I think fallaciously. But that was the reason that they initially put forward the issue as a camping ticket rather than a sleeping ticket. So continuing reading the final decision of Commissioner Joseph, before August 2, 2001, each of the defendants set up a campsite in an area now known as Camp Paradise with the intention of staying overnight. And again, none of this was proved. See, that's the point. That's what really disappointed me about Commissioner Joseph. There was the officers testified. They came out and said they saw people living there several months before. That they came out and they determined that they were in the vicinity of the tents. That they saw toilet. Seeley claimed he saw an open air toilet, which was denied by other people that there was no open air toilet. There was some other claimed there was a kitchen area there, which there is, but there was no establishing that at least three of the defendants, other than Larry Templeton, who was pretty much taken ownership of the camp in different times, or you know admitted he established and maintained it, that they were establishing and maintaining a campsite with the intention of remaining overnight in that particular case. I mean, maybe they had been for the last 3 months, and then they come back that morning. There's no proof that they were there at that time for that specific purpose. And you might say, well, you're nitpicking. Well, the prosecution is required to prove these elements, you know, and that is what they didn't do. But if you have a compliant judge, you don't have to prove those elements. So the defense finally, about midstream, they said, look, Your Honor, they haven't it's not being proved that the campsite was established and maintained with the intention of staying overnight. And Commissioner Joseph then simply said, well, I have a different interpretation of the law, and then went into no further explanation and never explained how he understood the law. Never explained to the defense, actually, the crime, other than camping, that they had to defend against. Because what Joseph was doing is he was saying, oh, come on, you know, they're camping. We know they're camping. Let's admit they're camping. I mean, that's we have to start there. I mean, isn't that true? I mean, it's common sense. They're camping. It's not common sense. You have to prove these people are violating the law. Yes, they may be camping, but is that what is prohibited? What is prohibited are the exact words of the statute. Otherwise, we have no way to defend ourselves in court if not by the words of the law. It doesn't say camping per se. It says camping is defined in the following way. And actually, there are three definitions. One is to sleep. And they weren't accused of sleeping, because that didn't happen. One is to set up bedding, and they weren't accused of setting up bedding. And the third is to establish and maintain a campsite with the intention of staying overnight. Those are the three definitions of camping. It wasn't to be present in an area with a sleeping bag, looking kind of frowsy and seeming to be like you'd been there the night throughout the night. That's not the definition according to the law. And so the definition according to the law not only wasn't proved, but the judge did not give an alternate definition that he was going on. He simply made his own decision sort of in the privacy of his own thought process without explaining to the rest of us what he was doing or explaining to the defendants what they were really charged with. So the next thing the defense did was they said, okay, fine, they were camping because, you know, we can't argue with you if you're not going to allow us to engage in basic due process here. But we claim that even though they were camping, they had a necessity to camp. And to do that, you have to prove six elements. One, that they were doing this to prevent a significant evil. Two, that they had no adequate alternative. Three, that they did this without creating a greater danger than the one they were avoiding. Four, that they had a good faith belief in their necessity of what they were doing. Five, that that belief was objectively reasonable. And six, that they did this under circumstances in which they did not substantially contribute to the necessity emergency that they were supposedly trying to avoid. Kind of a complicated matrix of things that the defense has to prove all six of these. And the judge found the defense didn't prove all six. In fact, the judge kind of rejected the idea that the defense had proved any of them, and therein kind of is the key for me to what this judge's decision is all about. If he had said, well, the defense proved A, B, and C, but didn't prove D, E, and F, and therefore you have to prove all six to win, it loses, I might have had more respect for him, though I would have quibbled, perhaps, about whether they proved it or not. But he seemed to imply with a broad brush that none of these things were proved, when in fact, for a number of these elements, the city attorney presented no opposition. And if no opposition is presented, the judge can't create opposition of his own. He's not the prosecuting attorney. If the prosecution doesn't dispute these things, although actually the prosecution did dispute it but didn't have any evidence to dispute it, then you're in a situation where at least you have to grant that the defense proved certain elements of the necessity defense. In case you just turned in, we're talking about Camp Paradise and the trial of the Camp Paradise Four, in which all four were found guilty, in which all four, however, had their sentences suspended, their $54, 8 hours of community service, actually, was the ultimate thing, suspended. And unfortunately, however, the concern is that the police are using this as a go-ahead to proceed with potential removal of Camp Paradise in the days ahead. And there are rumors that Labor Ready has already preparing to come down to the river next Tuesday, Wednesday to start removing Camp Paradise. Again, I don't have any ironclad guarantees of this. When I talked to Deputy City Manager Martine Bernal today, who Camp Paradise founder Larry Templeton and Friends of Camp Paradise activist Carl Wilson were trying to contact to have a conference so they could find out just what the heck is going on. What do the police intend to do? Things along the river, according to the Riley Resolution at City Council. And the Riley Resolution at City Council, as you may remember, was to enforce all ordinances along the San Lorenzo River as soon as possible. Meaning, get those Paradise people out of there fast. We're just too much of an embarrassment in the winter. Do something. Disperse them. We don't want them there. And so I'm not sure what actually is going to be happening. What we're looking at now, of course, is the court decision of Irwin Joseph. Reading on. Before August 2, 2001, each of the defendants set up a campsite in an area now known as Camp Paradise with the intention of staying overnight. This is evidenced by the tents occupied by each of the defendants and the other facilities and resources provided for the population at large. Again, as I've said, there was no evidence during the evidence trial that any of this stuff belonged to any of the people other than Larry Templeton that were there. There was never anything conclusively established. Because the judge sort of said he was going to rule anyway, the defense said, okay, you found us guilty of that, let's go on to the necessity defense. And that's what this ruling is really about. The defendants lived at Camp Paradise for periods ranging from a few days to almost 7 months before the citations were issued. During this time, each defendant, excepting perhaps Ms. Winchell, received notice, either actual or constructive, that the days of Camp Paradise were numbered. Police specifically assigned to assist homeless people came through the camp on various occasions during the first two quarters of 2001, prior to August 3rd, the date citations were issued. Camp Paradise is the name for an area of the San Lorenzo River levee, which before January of 2001 was a haven for drug activity. And this is a good paragraph for all of you who are feeling gloomy. The evidence is undisputed that the area was cleaned by its residents and appears to be in better condition now than it was before the campsite was established. Its residents are rightfully proud of their accomplishments, since each of them now has a living situation better than what they experienced before the camp was set up. Each of the defendants feels safe and comfortable in what appears to be an environment in which the residents watch out for and care for one another in a safe, sober, and cooperative-like environment. And I would remind you, this is a commissioner, just one level below a judge talking, Judge Irwin Joseph. Unfortunately for its residents, Joseph continues, Camp Paradise is not well equipped for permanent campers. There is no running water. There are no facilities for bathing or cleaning. Despite best efforts to establish some level of hygiene, questions about staff, maintenance of safe food preparation procedures and facilities, sewage, and longer-term environmental results from the campsite remain. Similarly, everyone understands that the rising San Lorenzo River is a hazard that is inevitable. I don't think that was understood that it's inevitable. Maybe 3 or 4 years down the road it's inevitable, but certainly not necessarily this winter. No testimony was presented to that effect in any expert fashion. The court must admire, Irwin Joseph continues, the court must admire the residents for their courage and intentions. Defendants propose that if in its evaluation of the evidence the court finds the defendants guilty, a defense of necessity has been proven. They rely on In re Icorn, a case not factually identical with the instant matter, but the basis upon which defendants raise their defense of necessity. Icorn approves a necessity defense being considered by the trier of fact. In that case, a single homeless person rolled out his sleeping bag on the steps of the Civic Center for one night. His defense included various reasons for his homelessness and his not being able to find space in shelters. The Court of Appeals decided that such a defense could be viable in the right circumstances, not to be considered by the trier of fact. Within the Icorn decision are the six prongs of the test for the defense. Each must be met or the defense will not rebut a guilty verdict. Each of the component parts is listed below, and I read these before. The decision requires that the defendant prove that he or she violated the law, 1, to prevent a significant evil, 2, with no apparent alternative, 3, without creating a greater danger than the one avoided, 4, with a good faith belief in the necessity, 5, with such belief being objectively reasonable, and 6, under circumstances in which he or she did not substantially contribute to the emergency. The Eichhorn case does not stand for the proposition, according to Joseph, that homeless people have the right to make campsites wherever they like because the shelters are unavailable and because the residents live cleanly. It provides a potential defense to certain charged crimes. The court finds that the establishment of a campsite, relatively permanent in nature, is not a necessity-justified response to the homeless condition in Santa Cruz as held in Eichhorn. Based on the offense charged, the defendants can't claim a necessity defense as tendered. If the defendants were charged with sleeping in a public place as opposed to erecting or maintaining a campsite, the result might be different. But the necessity defense to the sleep issue propounded by Eichhorn is not exemplified by the creation of a site with generator, portable toilets, community kitchen, and other resources for the numerous residents. The creation of Camp Paradise is not a necessary response to the plight of the homeless from a legal perspective in light of the present charges. That's kind of the core of the decision. I'm going to keep reading here. Stated differently, the creation and maintenance of Camp Paradise may be a response of dozens of homeless people to the lack of housing facilities in Santa Cruz, but it is an illegal response without adequate defense to the pending charges. Indeed, and here comes the apologia for the City Council, Santa Cruz County is an expensive place to live, and not just for the homeless or the residents of Camp Paradise. Committees and boards meet to discuss the housing dilemma, and as of now, there are no solutions provided by the city or county. The failure of the legislative branch of local government to provide a remedy does not affect the task given the court in these cases. The legislature and not the courts is vested with the responsibility to declare the public policy of the state. This is the official passing the buck. The testifying experts agree that there should be a compact or guarantee that the city provide housing for each of its residents. As of now, it is a goal and not a mandate. The final arguments of counsel, not considered evidence in any form by the court, ran the gamut from quoting 17th century philosopher Thomas Hobbes to exhortations worthy of a protester's placard. This case is about the criminalization of poverty. Neither of the characterizations is appropriate for these proceedings. Curiously, this court has researched the Hobbes quote and discovered that after counsel's quoted section, Hobbes continues in his treatise on war, and the treatise about Hobbes had something to be about without society, life is short, brutish, nasty, and so forth. And so the point being that the Camp Paradise people established a society to avoid that and deal with that. To this war of every man against every man, this also is consequent that nothing can be unjust. The notions of right and wrong, justice and injustice, have no place. He's talking about the theories of a 17th century royalist philosopher. Doesn't really have too much bearing on this, so I'm going to move on. Nothing could be further from the truth. Our society is not one in which right and wrong have no place. That's very ironic, given his decision. I would say it seems to be, in this particular case anyway, right and wrong don't seem to have too much place. Back to Eichhorn. Again, this is Commissioner Joseph again. If the defense were appropriate in the instant case, the court would find that with respect to the first prong, the evidence of relative levels of personal safety and improved environmental surroundings aren't enough to, quote, to show that they were trying to prevent a significant evil. Now, I'm going to stop here for a moment and point this out. The defense brought forward two key witnesses, Ken Cole, Homeless Services Center Director, and Paul Brindell, Community Action Board Project Director of the Shelter Project. Brindell testified that direct information from Chief Steve Belcher, a report uncontested, showed that homeless people are 3 to 5 times more likely to be the victim of violent assaults than those people in houses. Hence, it is much more dangerous to be homeless than it is to be housed, and it makes a lot of sense and is an important thing to form communities where people can guard against vigilante attacks and also against accidental medical conditions that come up. You're alone when these things happen off in the wilderness. You're more likely to get in trouble than if you're with people who are supportive. Hence the need to establish a campsite, hence the clear necessity. But yet, Joseph brushes this off. He doesn't really refer to those statistics at all. He just sort of makes the pronouncement that it's not enough. As to the second prong, with no adequate alternative, alternatives to Camp Paradise do exist. They just don't appeal to the residents who have tasted a caring community. What alternatives? Is he talking about sleeping illegally somewhere else? Is he talking about breaking into the August 3rd Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program, which was full that night? Another key piece of testimony was a piece of paper from Karen Brock, the Homeless Services Center worker, that said, "There is no space in the shelter. There will be no space in the shelter, we expect, for the rest of the summer. It's no good. There is no legal shelter in Santa Cruz." Neither the prosecution, City Attorney Pouchot, nor Commissioner Joseph proposed any alternatives, and there's no alternatives proposed in this decision. He simply states there are alternatives. Does he mean leave the county, leave the city? He doesn't say that. So it's all, again, key things are missing here that might have given his decision some credibility. But of course, the reason they're missing is there's nothing to fill them in with except power, except naked power, and the assertion that this is how it is. Swallow it and like it. Reviewing the third prong, without creating a greater danger than the one avoided, the court finds the establishment of an illegal campsite in a dangerous, ill-equipped, environmentally sensitive, flood-threatened place is not more persuasive than an alternative. But he doesn't say what alternative, again. And this flood-threatened thing, which much has been made of, flooding happens every 3 to 10 years. It's not clear how often it floods. I hear different estimates from different people. So, and there's also been the Quakers were announced at City Council through a representative. They were prepared to let people stay at their church for 3 days if there were flooding as a sort of an emergency evacuation process. And indeed, it wouldn't be hard to simply open up the gates of the cemetery and climb up that hill and have people get out. Indeed, some of their stuff would be washed away, but since they're aware of what they're doing, and indeed, perhaps as the rain, if there is such a continuous rain that happens, they would probably begin to move their stuff out anyway. It's something that has to be balanced. You have to balance that concern with the concern of the dangers of being alone or elsewhere in a situation where you're more likely to be attacked or to suffer from other problems that come up. The impassioned pleas and the other three prongs of the defense he doesn't talk about at all. So he gives essentially no clear evidence as to what he feels shows that each of these things were not met, at least not for my money. The impassioned pleas of the attorneys reflect the frustration of the situation faced by homeless people every day and demonstrated by the evidence received. But the system of justice, the notions of right and wrong, are not to be disregarded because of the failure of a social contract between government and its citizens. So those who want to look on the bright side can say, look, he's talking about the failure of the social contract. He's talking about the failure of the city to provide the shelter it should provide, which is all very well. But unfortunately, his decision opens the door for the police to come down, as they did the next day. They went to Camp Paradise the Tuesday after the Monday this court decision was rendered, and Homeless Resource Officer Eric Seeley reportedly said, we're going to be back to tear up or slash up or take away those tents next week if you're still here. And some would say, well, Seeley has been making those kinds of threats in the last few months, and the city council has said you can go in and you should go do that because you should remove them as soon as possible. But my deep throat source that I have actually in the sheriff's department says that the police were really avoiding trying to do this, but they're getting pressured by the city council to move on Camp Paradise. They said they needed to wait until they got a decision from the court, and this is the decision. It's got enough sweetness and light around the edges. It says, we're not going to send anybody to jail here. We're not going to even fine you or make you do community service. We just may make you sit through this nerve-wracking trial, and tomorrow the police can do the same thing again to you. And by the way, now the police can go ahead and remove the entire camp. So this is not a good decision. The final order is, each defendant is charged with violating 6.36.010C of the Santa Cruz Municipal Code, an infraction. Each defendant is charged with setting up or maintaining a campsite. The court finds each of the defendants guilty of the charged offense. The defense offered is both inappropriate to the crime charged and not proven. That's the necessity defense. With respect to sentencing, the court suspends the sentence of Mr. Jepson, Squirrel, and Ms. Phillips, K, the woman in the wheelchair, based on their physical health and financial circumstances. The court orders Mr. Templeton and Ms. Winchell to perform 8 hours of community service. The court believes from the evidence that each resident of Camp Paradise that is physically able has spent numerous hours improving the area. Therefore, as to those remaining defendants, the court gives each credit for having already performed at least that number of hours working for the good of the residents of Camp Paradise, and thereby suspends any further sentence, dated November 23rd, Irwin Joseph, Commissioner, Superior Court. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, and if you're wondering what this elaborate babble about legal matters has been, it's the Camp Paradise trial. The homeless folks charged with setting up a campsite by the riverside, they're still there as of tonight, in spite of the rains, in spite of the police, in spite of these court decisions, in spite of a city council that, at city council on Tuesday, refused to move on the depot site. That is to say, they refused to even allow the city manager's office to consider the depot site. That's the site where the old depot is as a possible campsite to be added to an investigation of other campsites, specifically in De La Vega Park, San Lorenzo Benchlands, and Harvey West Park. So it's hard, and of course the person who pulled this off the agenda was the same nervous Nelly that put it on the agenda, Ed Porter, or Pinprick Porter as I call him, because of his hypersensitivity to criticism, his inability to address issues in an open way, his unresponsiveness and unwillingness to return phone calls, and to engage in public dialogue on these issues, which is really very important. But anyway, Porter did attempt to put these issues on the agenda, but then when numerous residents complained they didn't want to even have the issue discussed, he said, oh, I'll have to go meet with them privately before we can even discuss it publicly. And it's not a bad idea to meet with residents before you do this, but once you've got everybody to the council meeting, and if you're only going to be investigating the issue only anyway, and if there's an emergency coming up where the police are coming after people and saying, unless you move out of there, we're going to arrest you, it's time to move the process along and provide some real alternatives. And that, of course, is what the city council is not doing at all. And that's why the community needs to step in and say, look, Camp Paradise, we're going to try to support you if you stay where you are as long as you can, or if you move to another site because the either environmental conditions make it impossible to stay, or because the police come in and start taking your tents and arresting you. There has to be community support that says we will not allow this to happen in a caring community. If the city council abrogates its responsibility, if the judge rubber stamps the city council, if the police dutifully follow the city manager's orders because the city manager thinks that he can, it's the good old days and homeless people don't count for shit, well, the community has to stand up and say no. And they have to do something like they did in Oregon and in Washington. In both Seattle and in Portland, what they did was they established, homeless people themselves established tent cities, illegal tent cities, supported by the community. And the public support that these cities had, just as Camp Paradise has gotten public support, made it very, very difficult to act to tear down those tent cities or arrest those folks. And in fact, they are still up there today. Seattle's been up there for several years, and they move from place to place. And Portland has been up there for about a year and a month now. Well, actually about a year now. So, we all need to support this effort, and of course Camp Paradise isn't the only group of homeless people that should be under our spotlight. Camp Paradise has gotten a lot of support from a lot of people, but I think that Camp Paradise, I've been hearing them talking more and more about their concern about the sleeping ban generally and the homeless population generally. In fact, I'm going to play a little bit now of the aftermath of this all. Yesterday I was down interviewing Larry Templeton and some other folks at Camp Paradise, seeing what's happening. I'm going to play that interview now. And I invite you to, again, call in at 427-3772 here at Free Radio and join us at 96.3 and chat. You know, give us your thoughts on what this is all worth. Okay, well, it's November 28th. It's around 1:30. We're talking to Larry Templeton. We've got Doug McGrath and Carl Wilson and Becky Johnson here. Hey there, Larry.
Hey, what's up?
Well, that's what I'm wondering. You had a conversation with the Chief Belcher last night at City Council, or yesterday?
Yeah.
And what was that about?
Trying to find us a place where we're going to do. Where are we going to go next?
Did he approach you? Did you approach him?
I approached him.
And what did you ask him?
I asked him, I said, you know, you got police officers coming down threatening to tear our tents up. And he says, you're breaking the law. I said, where are we supposed to go? And he said, I was getting rude with him. Oh. And he goes, you know, you're breaking the law. He goes, and I will arrest you. I says, well, come and arrest then. And he says, well, I don't want to talk to you with your attitude. He says, you've been drinking. Well, you know what? Give me one of your tests, buddy. You'll fail. Because your breath smells like alcohol, not mine.
So he didn't, in essence, say anything about any...
It smelled like alcohol.
Was there any plan that he mentioned to come down and arrest people on the riverbank, or...?
No, he said Seeley's going to do his job. I says, you mean that he can come down and tear my camp up? Yes, he can. His exact words. They can come down and tear my camp up, and what's going to be so bad is they're going to have homeless people tear homeless people's camps up. They're hiring people from Labor Ready. It's already on their board.
Now, do you have any sense as to when this is likely to happen?
Sometime, they say they're going to start tearing around Camp Paradise before this weekend, and then the following week, there'll be Camp Paradise. They're saying it will take 3 days to clear down Camp Paradise. They better not touch my camp.
Now, who is saying this?
Officer Seeley.
This is what he said. Now, he came to your camp yesterday morning?
Yes, he did.
And about what time of day was it?
About 11. About between 10:30 and 11.
What was the purpose of his visit?
To see how many tents we had still set up, to let us know that they will be coming 1 week to tear the camps down. He told me that they're going to tear around Camp Paradise this week. Before the weekend, they're going to hit all the camps around us. But they gave them notices.
When are they going to hit Camp Paradise?
Next week.
What time? Did
they
give a day?
He just says, you better be ready next week because we will come and tear you down. I said, what do you mean, we? He says, well, we hired Labor Ready.
That's what Officer Seeley said.
Yep.
Was he alone or did he have anybody with him?
He had two other officers with him I never seen before. It wasn't the same little buddies. So.
Now, did he say anything regarding, how long did you guys talk?
Maybe five, six minutes.
And, you know, Officer Seeley in the past has made threats that turned out to be idle. What do you feel about this most recent threat?
I think he's for real this time. You know, he says, you lost. He thinks we lost. I don't think we did.
Court had decision.
Yeah.
Because on Monday, the court decided that the necessity defense did not apply to you and the three others who took it to trial. Of course, that could be appealed.
Yes, it's going to be appealed.
Now, do you have any thoughts about, did Officer Seeley or Chief Belcher give you any alternatives? They say they were provided vouchers or there was a space open. Did they suggest the armory?
They didn't suggest nothing. They go, they got an armory. I says, you already heard it from Ken Cole's statement on the stand that I will be not eligible for one of them beds at the armory. I'm not eligible.
And how many people in the camp would you say are not eligible for armory? Have you done any kind of analysis of that?
Over three quarters of the camp won't be eligible.
I would encourage you to have a meeting or have people come in one by one and talk to them about what their eligibility is for any shelter in town. Because
we talked to Ken Cole. Ken Cole says there is nothing. He said he'd be willing to even say it to anybody. There is no room for people like over here at Camp Paradise. There is no room.
But they're saying, you see, that the armory has spaces. They have. I don't know. I haven't checked last night, but I heard that they said the night before. Ed Porter insisted that the armory had spaces in the morning. There is an issue of picture IDs, but which are being required by armories because of the terrorist emergency.
Yeah.
We're not talking about Officer Seeley and the terror that is going to be inflicted on Camp Paradise here.
How many people at the camp don't have the proper IDs to get into the armory?
About every one of us.
What you need to do is document that. Be honest about it. See who has IDs. See.
Another thing about the armory. Why do we want to be around a bunch of drunks? Drugs being sold right there at the armory. I was there. I was a monitor.
When were you a monitor?
2 years ago.
What period of time?
It was through the winter months. And then I was a monitor at the shelter last year, at the bay. You know, I don't want to be around them kind of people. They let it go on. I'm not going to. We don't want to be there. Yeah, we use the facilities to take our showers, wash our clothes.
How many people in camp right now?
There's about 32 of us.
And our people
were referred by the Homeless Persons Health Project.
Your name is?
Doug McGrath.
Who's we, you and your partner?
Marilyn and I, we have dogs, and we're unable to qualify for the armory.
You weren't housing until recently, right?
Right. And my wife's mother has some property, but we're out of that right now. There's some problems. families worried about inheritance and stuff.
It happens, families. You know, you can live there for a certain period of time and then...
Well, I was just married to my wife, and it kind of changes a lot of the inheritance. But on top of that, we were sent there by Lynn at the Homeless Persons Health Project.
In the Camp Paradise.
Camp Paradise, and where we are. Because we don't qualify for anywhere else, and there is nowhere else to go.
How long have you been there?
We've been there since Saturday. So, you know, we've been there about 5 days.
How is it?
We're doing fine. I like being relaxed. At least my wife could go to work, and so we could get some things done. We're working on making wreaths to sell for Christmas, just like they do downtown. And but then now, you know, the cops put this shadow. You don't know when they're going to come down and tear everything up. So it's hard to be focused and, you know, stay serene again. You don't know what to do. You know, you're back on jumping around again, you know.
Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.
We're talking with Larry Templeton down at camp. It's 5 to 3. Hey, Larry, you've actually been to the armory before.
Yeah, all right. Right now it's 5 to 3. Okay, you got to be there in 35 minutes to get on that armory list. All right, right now we have 15 people from camp that's out working their full-time job. They will never make it there in 35 minutes. Never. And the list is already full.
Now, is there a late-night pickup? Hey, Becky? Let me ask her, because she's been keeping on tabs on this stuff. They may do a late-night pickup, although I don't know if that's... They're doing a late-night pickup at the armory this year, do we know?
No.
No late-night pickup?
No, that's been promised for years, and they've never been able to manage to do that.
Yeah, so, and even then, you know, one thing, they want to talk about their drug and alcohol programs. They want to use that against us? Okay. What does their drug and alcohol program say? If you want to stop using, get away from the people that use. I'm not going to go up there and lay around with a bunch of drunks, because that's one of my bad drugs.
So,
check.
Your name is Rex.
Go ahead, Rex.
There's nobody can go into the armory without ID now.
Picture ID.
Yeah, picture ID. It's all shelters like that. You have to have ID for it now. So.
You're washing some pots, Rex. Are you? How long you been
clean around here? So.
Yeah. How long you been in the camp?
For about a month and a half now.
How do you like it?
I like it. It's pretty cool. It gets me out. It keeps me. This camp here keeps me from causing trouble out there. It keeps me out of trouble.
And what's your name?
Rexus.
Hey, Rexus. And what? How long you been here?
Same month and a half.
And are you keeping yourself? Are you giving him trouble here? What's going on?
No, been doing what he's been telling me to do and everything. And
no,
everything.
You don't want to do that too much. You do what I tell you to do. That's important. So, any problems at Camp Paradise? Any ways you think it could be improved? What do you think the camp needs?
They should let us have more time here. The city should let us have more time here. So. Some of us get up back on our feet like that, you know, because...
I mean, would they rather us be all here together, staying out of trouble, doing no drugs and alcohol, or having us pitching tents and putting tents underneath every bridge and in backyards and shit like that? Would they rather have a whole bunch of people spread out through the city like that, or have everybody in one place? It's better here instead of having to have people go put tents underneath bridges and... finding places to sleep and sleeping in doorways of stores and stuff like that. It's a lot better down here. We're out of the view of people, you know? And they don't understand that.
Damn it! Stop taking a shit right there. Thank you. And that was Camp Paradise residents yesterday responding to the police early morning rousts and warnings the day after the trial and the decision by Commissioner Joseph, which I read. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. If you want to call in, we're at 427-3772. Here's a call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, this is Steve Weiss. How are you doing?
I'm good, Steve. You've got a group on campus, so have you got a name for yourselves? Or?
Yeah, definitely. We're the National Student Campaign Against Hunger and Homelessness under the auspices of CalPERG. Uh-huh. And we're going to be starting HUF UCSC next quarter.
Oh, right. HUF. Listen, I don't try to get Mike Rutkin to sponsor it. I don't know. Well, he might, actually. He likes to pride himself on being a civil libertarian.
Anybody that would like to be a part of it is more than welcome to join, of course.
And how do people join HUF UCSC or the CalPERG National Conference? Give me the phrase.
National Student Campaign Against Hunger and Homelessness. We're a network of 600 universities and other schools dedicated to bringing awareness change in our society.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's been happening? I know that you've had a lot of rain on the last couple of days, and you had a week in which you gathered numerous items of clothing and I guess food staples and such. And to me, that, of course, I'm always, you know, it's a charity drive, and I don't get too excited about that because it's not something that changes the status of homeless people. But it's always nice to, you know, have a little something. Some blankets are nice when it's cold. Some food is nice when you're hungry. No question about that.
Well, it's more than just the direct action of providing the food or the clothing or the blankets. It's really getting people involved at some level because, you know, people often feel like these kinds of issues are too much to tackle, and therefore they don't try at all.
Mm-hmm.
And to get them started on doing at least something and seeing some immediate results for people is very important.
Mm-hmm.
And once you have that foundation established, you know, where you get people involved at a small level, they're more likely to get involved at deeper levels, of course.
A good theory, but have you gotten anybody involved in the last few weeks after this 1 week of in the national call was over?
Well, you know, I really can't tell you, you know, what people have in mind in terms of whether or not they're going to be joining our group. I know that people are always busy, especially, you know, at
finals.
The UC level. It's very demanding.
Mm-hmm.
And our meetings, we have meetings Wednesday at 7 p.m. In the student center there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's often difficult for people to make it out to the meetings. However, the response from the people, from the students on campus donating food, was enormous.
Mm-hmm.
Hundreds of students. And it means that, you know, we have an opportunity to contact those students again and say, hey, we're doing the annual hunger cleanup, or you know, we're going to be getting people out there tabling to fight the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz. You know,
right.
Would you like to come out and be a part of that? And they're more likely to do that.
That is encouraging. I know that you, I'm just concerned about you having to hold down a lonely table as you struggle to get your, you know, exams together and your finances together all at the same time. Everything, you know, it's a difficult situation for you. And I'm just, you know, I know for me, I run around doing these, you know, lone wolf activities and trying to alert other people to concerns that I think they have to get into. But it's, you really need an organization. You need a number of people doing it. And if I can be of help, or any Huff people downtown could be of help, we have our meeting, as you know, and you've been to several of them, on Wednesday at 8:30 at Baker Square down in the morning.
Right.
So you're, you know, give a call. And of course, you have, and you are. I guess you mentioned to me you'd written a letter to City on a Hill, which is the, every Thursday comes out a weekly publication from UCSC, right?
Yeah, it's basically, the letter itself is describing how inhumane it is to treat homeless people as what it sounds like to me as maybe nocturnal subhuman beings.
Mm-hmm.
As if people don't need to sleep, and, you know, like you were saying earlier, to not provide any alternatives for these people is even more of an injustice. In fact, I dare say the biggest crime is not violating the sleeping ban so much as it is creating the sleeping ban.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like to put that judge on trial. And maybe he would like to camp out for a night and not have the intention of sleeping and see how that feels, especially in this time of year when the, you know, when the winter's the winter cold is relentless.
You know, I tried to bring this issue to, I call him King Christopher Crone. He was crowned mayor two nights ago. They had a reception for Crone and Vice Mayor Emily, parking signs in Harvey West driveway, homeless people Riley, who is now vice mayor. And I, you know, I kind of, she, I didn't, wasn't able to talk to her, but I talked to Crone a little bit before he kind of snuck off under cover of his children. He often does that. He uses his kids as cover. It's kind of a sad thing. He uses these little kids that, you know, always too busy taking care of them. He can't talk to you, you know. He's you know, the issue, Crone originally came to power, and he and Sugar, on the very a month after they came to power, they tried to keep their commitment to lots of people who said, we want you to end the sleeping ban or at least suspend it over the winter. And they were beaten back by Fitzmaurice and then Catherine Byers on the city council. And then a year later, they weren't able to get the safe sleeping zones passed because, quote, they didn't have the votes. And again, it was Catherine Byers who betrayed that effort. You don't know her, probably, but she was the one-time liberal who, like Kennedy, became conservative on this issue and on a lot of other issues, too, actually. But now they have a majority. They can pass ending the sleeping ban. And, in fact, if anybody brought it up, they'd have a hard time doing anything else. I mean, they'd have to do something because the issue has been so documented and so debated in their own commissions. Their own commissions have said end the sleeping ban. But they don't. Their response is to subvert the democratic process. They won't allow it to hit the agenda. And that's what Crone told me at this meeting, at this reception, that unless he had the votes beforehand, he wouldn't bring it up. Which, of course, is not the way a democracy is supposed to proceed. You're supposed to bring up something, debate it, persuade the community, and get the votes. And if you don't get the votes, at least you've done the educational process. So, on campus, you've also been working with, I guess, supervisorial candidate Michael Schmidt, who I understand today either got or didn't get the nod from the Women's Democratic Club at noon today. They were going to decide between him, Marty Wormhout, and Pat Fremmer, the librarian for supervisor. Have you done any talking with this Schmidt character?
Yes, I have. In fact, Michael Schmidt is extremely impressive to me. Somebody who can walk the walk as well as talk the talk. Those characteristics are definitely exemplified by him. And I like to see somebody, you know, not only running for city council and being involved with politics, but actually...
Board of Supervisors is what he's running for.
Board of Supervisors.
Right, which is, you know, it's county rather than city, but it's similar, you know.
Oh,
similar
it's all
scene.
Politics.
Yeah, it's actually sure. It's actually a better paid position, and it commands more power in a certain sense. Marty Wormhout, who is currently supervisor, was once a city council member and a mayor, and a very bad mayor at that, in my view, at least on homeless issues. She was arresting people and so forth. She isn't much better as a supervisor.
Well, in any case, he's the right man for the job, and I like his attitude. I like the way that he treats people as people and not as animals. And we certainly don't encourage animals to sleep in the cold. We harbor them, and we harbor prisoners. I don't see why we can't harbor homeless
Maybe
people.
We should open up the SBCA for the homeless. You know, we could have a special Be Kind to a Homeless Person week. And kind of try to persuade the city council to... We could have homeless people come around on chains like pets and say you should treat them at least as well as you do your doggies. You know, I don't know. Some kind of satirical response is necessary here because, unfortunately, sheer rational argument and screaming doesn't seem to get through either to these folks.
Well, it sounds like nobody could persuade the judge otherwise, even in light of testimony that was perfectly valid.
Well, the impressive thing was that the city attorney apparently either was so nervous about the case, he didn't send a competent person to really deal with this. And no offense to the deputy assistant cub attorney that they sent in, this Jennifer Pouchot, but she didn't even know enough to do a... at the end of every trial, you have the prosecution sums up, the defense sums up, and then the prosecution makes a final argument. She didn't even know to make a final argument. She wasn't there. I mean, she was floundering, and yet, you know... The judge was giving her life rafts.
the defendants have appointed you as attorney?
Could they have appointed me?
Yeah.
No. The it's not that the attorneys were bad. The attorneys were good. It was that the judge, you know, it's really hard to look inside someone's mind. But I mean, I really came to the conclusion that there was politically motivated stuff here.
He made his decision before the trial even began.
It sounds to me like he thinks, you know, you're supposed to judge on the basis of the wording of the law. But he judged, first of all, he decided they were guilty beyond a reasonable doubt by looking at the common sense meaning of the word camping. And probably that would persuade an average person that they were camping by ordinary definitions of the word camping, but that's not what we look at. You look at the law when you look at the camping ban, and he didn't do that. Then in the necessity defense, you're supposed to consider each of those points individually and whether, you know, you consider what the evidence the prosecution puts forward versus the defense, and he didn't. The prosecution put forward no evidence on a number of those prongs, and yet he didn't indicate that the defense won any of them. Of course, I'm repeating myself here.
What can we do on campus? What suggestions do you have for us, as students, to take action?
Students are really powerful, and students have done different things on different campuses. And here in Santa Cruz, they've actually done sleepouts at the town clock, and they've done mass arrests. I would like to see a student homeless... renter coalition that does a kind of a tent. You could set up a tent city on the edge of campus if you could get enough students to support you, as students have done in other universities up at Berkeley. They did a joint homeless action to save some housing, and also to, not just for homeless people, but to stop the destruction of this housing. And of course at Harvard they did a joint action, I believe it was for equal wage, or I should say living wage, as well as to support homeless people. So I think there can be a joint use here. I don't know if you have... The real problem for you, of course, is to find the people to help you to do it.
Right.
You know? I like to see people getting into activism directly, but you're suggesting, well, you got to get your toes wet, and you got to kind of, you know, you got to get into it a little at a time.
Not everybody is ready to jump in and be arrested for this cause.
Correct.
I will.
Aha, you're under arrest.
But, you know, certainly with, there's a lot of problems. It's a bleak situation, as you know. On campus, there's a, we have, you know, Tim Fitzmaurice is actually part of campus, as you very well know.
Yeah.
As is Mike Rodkin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the food waste on campus is another big issue. Not to take anything away from the sleeping ban, but so much food is thrown away at these cafeterias, and I'm still looking for ways to organize people to, you know, definitely save that food and bring it out to the people who need it.
Mm-hmm. Good for you.
But,
well, I can think of different ideas. It depends on the person power you have. I would say the first thing you need to do is get 5 or 10 students who are willing to put in a couple hours a week, even, because this is the key time, unfortunately. It's both the time when you have the most intensive academic pressure, but also the time when the community is listening, because it's Thanksgiving, Christmas, and it's also the time when the merchants are vulnerable to pressure.
Yeah, well,
so it's a difficult situation. You know?
It's unfortunate that it takes that kind of pressure, and the fact that we have this, we just recently, you know, had the Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week.
Mm-hmm.
I think far too many people believe that maybe hunger and homelessness is over after that week.
Oh, yeah.
It's just for that week that it applies.
That's the reason I'm so skeptical of such drives, is that they're an opportunity for people to, you know, purge their consciences and move on, and that's you know, unfortunate, which a lot of us do on a lot of issues. You know, we try to give a token thing because we don't know what to do. There's so many things around us demanding our attention. You know, I'm thinking... tabling is difficult in the you're, I guess you're going to be tabling on campus and you but having to do that without a lot of support is a trying situation. Maybe just gathering a core of people, doing some events.
Certainly. Well, we have, like I said, we have the Hunger Cleanup coming up. That's in April. But prior to that, we're going to be doing a food waste survey on campus. We're definitely going to be, you know, getting the word out. In fact, I plan on holding a dinner event where...
How about homeless students? I'm sorry, go ahead. Dinner event.
Homeless students, that's a wonderful idea. I mean,
when you have homeless students on campus, how about setting up a table as a support group for homeless students, or having a vehicle with a guy, have someone studying at a table outside, but that also serves as a contact point for homeless students or for people who are supportive of homeless students.
That'd be great. Huff on Campus, that's their first project.
Right, and you would do that, you would do it at night, and so it would be, you know, it would be a kind of a center. You would no doubt get hassled from the administration, no doubt, but...
Well, specifically from the police, and I've actually spoken with a police officer, and he was difficult at best when I was asking him the nitty-gritty about the legality of staying out there. Regardless of whether we are sleeping or not.
It sounds to me like if you have a First Amendment right to certainly to vigil if you want. I mean, you can't, if you're awake, you know, you can't be arrested. If you're at a table with a voter registration sheath and a clipboard, they're going to arrest you for that. They're actually violating federal law, and they themselves hopefully become vulnerable for civil rights prosecutions, although, you know, it's always problematic in these courts.
The potential backlash is also a real problem.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we're out there demonstrating against this, if we're out there staying all night doing a vigil...
Mm-hmm.
Homeless students themselves are going to risk having their whatever kinds of temporary shelters they've set up. Are, you know, they're going to risk that being their locations being found out and those being destroyed. Just like
so, maybe what you need is house students, like doing proxy duty for homeless students. And if you could find from your lists people who you think would be most likely to be active, just to sort of start. Who wants to volunteer for this? Where you could actually, you'd have to do your studying outside. You have to, you know, be in a warm coat. You'd have to be under an area somewhere where you're not going to get rained on, and you'd need to have a light, obviously, to be able to continue doing the kind of work that students have to do.
Well, it'd also be nice.
Yeah.
I think that's great. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Yeah.
Actually, just full on asking students if they would, you know, let the homeless students couch surf.
That's good too.
You know, like I would, if I have any availability, I'll definitely try to do that too. I mean,
uh-huh.
What it takes here is compassion, and people. People often get lost in this world and in the materialism and focusing more on their wants than their needs. And I think we need to get back to the basics in terms of just remembering that human beings are, you know, that we're these very vulnerable creatures who need love, who need shelter and food. And with these basics, that's what it takes to survive. And without them, we have death by exposure, illness, and malnutrition. Really plaguing society. I mean, it's pandemic in America.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree. And, you know, it's So it's also the death of love and caring, which is pretty bad. It can happen to individuals, and it can happen to, I suppose, to societies in a broad way, too.
Well, we just need to throw some more wood on the fire. I mean, we have a flame there. We just need to, you know, allow it to grow.
How can people contact you to be helpful to... are you calling yourself... you're calling yourself... We still have the long name? Give me that name again.
Well, my email is themonsterofsoul.
Themonsterofsoul.
@yahoo.com.
@yahoo.com. We're talking, of course, with Steve Weiss. And Steve, you're...
I'm a junior at UC Santa Cruz.
You got a phone number?
Yes. I'll give you my home phone number for all you loyal listeners. Mm-hmm. It's 427-0270.
427-0270.
And you can call day or night. Doesn't matter what time.
Huh. That's good. I will try not to call you, however, because we want to interrupt your sleep.
Well, you know what? It sounds like a lot of homeless folks out there, their sleep is being interrupted, too.
Right, and as Howard Zinn said, that we should interrupt the sleep of those who pass these anti-homeless laws. And
certainly.
So, thank you for calling. I haven't given you any answers. I don't really have any answers, but maybe some folks out there have, so listen in, and we'll see if we can scamper up here.
Well, thank you very much for the ideas and for, you know, letting me be a part of this discussion.
Hey, you're welcome.
And I will see you at the Huff meeting for sure.
Okay.
All right, and everybody should. Everybody out there.
Come to the Huff meeting, folks.
Definitely.
Alrighty.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, that Huff meeting is Wednesday, of course, 8:30 in the morning at Baker's Square. There's a protest tomorrow, by the way, that I read about on the Internet. This was forwarded to me by activist Becky Johnson. Free speech protest to be held at Scotts Valley Police Department. Oh, for all of you, I've never been up to Scotts Valley Police Department. It's going to be a first for me. In response to a recent police conduct which directly interfered with the First Amendment rights of local citizens, a protest, including picketing and other actions, will be held as follows. Friday, November 30th, 1:30 p.m., Scotts Valley Police Station, 1 Civic Center Drive, Scotts Valley. I have no idea where that is, but I'm sure it shouldn't be that hard to find. This event is being held in response to repressive actions taken by Scotts Valley police officers on Monday at approximately 7:30 a.m. at the Granite Creek Overpass in Scotts Valley. A banner reading, "At What Cost?" with a skeleton pictured at the bottom, was placed next to an American flag and opposite a sign that said, "Santa Cruz..."